It's time for Hamilton County Goes to the Movies. This is a weekly podcast with Adam Austin, writer for the weekly publication Current in Carmel. You can read his material at currentincarmel.com. My name is Larry Lannon. I write a local news blog from Fishers, Indiana at larryinfishers.com. This week, Adam and I review a new film previewed at the Heartland Film Festival, LBJ. Adam recorded a short conversation with director Rob Reiner. You'll hear that in just a few minutes. Later, our guest is Dan Cavallini, producer and cinematographer for a new short film, Homecoming, shot mostly in the Lawrence area. Let's get started. Welcome once again to Hamilton County Goes to the Movies. Once again, we're here at Donatello's Italian Restaurant at 9 West Main Street in downtown Carmel. And once again, Adam Austin is here. And Adam, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Larry.
And we were just a few days ago before recording this on the red... I never thought I'd ever be on a red carpet, but I was standing on a rope line next to a red carpet at the Heartland Film Festival. That was an exciting opening night.
Yeah, they did a really good job putting it on. Kudos to everyone involved in Heartland Film Festival. And Greg Sorvig was very kind in getting us passes and set up there. And they did a great job.
What, just so people know, when you're on one of those red carpets and you have a rope line, they actually have cardboard cutouts and the name of who you are. It could be Wish TV. It could be the Indianapolis Star. We had Hamilton County at the movies. They put our own little area. Now, we weren't, you know, in a prime location, but we were there.
And we're pretty new. It's okay.
Yeah, and that's okay. No, I'm just glad to be there. Greg Sorvig, who was on this program a few weeks ago, was very kind to us, and I appreciate everything he did. And I saw him just the day before we record this, and congratulated him on a terrific opening night. Did you go to the party afterwards?
Yes, I did. Yeah. They had Josh Kaufman perform an acoustic set, and it was very nice. I got to talk to some of the people from the owners of Curt and Carmel were there, which I was like seeing Brian Kelly and his wife Maggie, and Frank and Katrina Basile, who was a former head of Heartland and former head of the Palladium. And so there was a lot of really nice people there.
Frank Basile is legendary as far as his charitable work and work in the arts around.
And if you ever need a travel recommendation, he's been everywhere.
But he's a very nice man,
yeah,
too.
Yes.
And that's the best thing you can say. Well, as I said, it was my first time on the red carpet, and there were lots of people there. I came this close to getting an interview with Chaz Ebert, and then they sent her away. I'm going to talk more about her later in the program. But what we did do, we were waiting for Rob Reiner, the director of LBJ, which is the film that was being shown on opening night of the Heartland Film Festival. And needless to say, he was in demand, that every time a journalist or a TV crew or whatever got a hold of him, they kept him for 5, 10, 15 minutes. We waited patiently. We knew we weren't on the A-list, but all that waiting paid off. So, Adam, you got to ask him 3 questions. Very good questions, I must say.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. So
I got to hold the mic and you got to ask the question.
First, I had kind of my selfie stick. I was going to use that to record myself because I wanted to be on camera too, so it looked more professional. But then my wife showed up and I asked her to hold the camera for me, and she was a trooper. She felt a little anxious with the crowds, and especially since showtime was about to happen, but she was very nice. I kind of joke with her, maybe I should ask him about the Harvey Weinstein situation. And she said, don't you dare, I'll walk away.
Now, of course, the Indianapolis Star did.
They did. Yeah. So I said, hey, you know, I could have asked him about it. He actually had a pretty good answer. He talked. Yeah. He kind of brought it back to Trump, which isn't, you know, he's a Democrat and he's in California, so he's very much into those things.
And he was an elected official at one time in state government. In California, so.
Yeah, and he was very nice. And Larry, I should have let you ask the questions.
Oh,
you
had right.
You have a much better radio voice than me. I was listening to some of our past podcasts. I sound like a high schooler sometime I think I need to start smoking 2 packs a day to get the radio voice that you have.
I was a mumbler as a kid. I had to learn how to do this, but I've always said it's not your voice. It's do you know what you're talking about? So, Adam, you know what you're talking about.
I appreciate that,
and that's the most important thing. So it was almost hand-to-hand combat when you're trying to get a hold of Rob Reiner, but we finally did. He was, and I must say, he was a very nice man. You know, he's been asked the same question 50 to 100 times, and he smiles and he gives the same answer. Sometimes he'll say, you know, I've been asked that question before. I'll give you the same answer. But it wasn't in an angry sort of way. It was like, yeah, I do get asked that a lot, but I'm going to give you the answer so you can have it. Just a very regular guy. I mean, that's the impression I got, just being around him a short time. So, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at his work, he hasn't had a lot of hits recently, but if you look at his string of hits he's had, probably from This Is Spinal Tap all the way to The American President, you know, a lot of great films there. Misery, Stand By Me, When Harry Met Sally, The Princess Bride. He's got hit after hit. And has he ever been nominated for an Oscar?
That I do not remember.
Well,
should have Googled that before we start.
Regardless of that, regardless of any Oscar nomination or critical acclaim, you have to put him in there with some of the best directors of our generation.
Well, you'll hear in a moment. My favorite question that you asked him was, "How does your approach to comedy differ from your father's, Carl Reiner, who was one of the great comedy writers in the early days of television?" So, gave a good answer on that one. So, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to go back to the last Thursday before we recorded this. Opening night, Heartland Film Festival. Poor Rob Reiner had been talking to the media for at least an hour, and he did take a few moments to talk to us, and here's Adam talking to him.
Nice to see you. All right, with Rob Reiner here, famed film director. So you got your film LBJ tonight. Why now for this film? Is there something about today's political climate that kind of makes the film resonate nowadays?
You know what's funny? It does resonate, but we made it a while ago, and it was finished actually before Trump was in the White House. And now it's a completely different film. You look at it in a different way. I mean, you know, there have been many films made about race relations and civil rights, but all of a sudden this issue has bubbled up to the surface because of Trump in the White House, and so now it all of a sudden becomes a very, you know, current film, even though it was an issue that we were dealing with over 50 years ago and 100 years before that. It's become a very, relevant issue, and you'll see when you see the film.
So two of my favorite comedies of all time, This Is Spinal Tap and your dad's film, The Jerk.
Oh, yeah.
So how does you and your dad's comedy styles compare? How does it differ?
They're different. I mean, I think my dad, you know, he came out of sketch comedy in the 50s, so his has a kind of a sketchier edge. Mine's a little bit maybe closer to the bone.
So it's the anniversary of The Princess Bride.
Right.
Favorite quote from the movie?
My favorite quote, I would have to say, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
I've seen that on many a T-shirt.
I would have to say that one, yeah.
So, well, have enjoyed the film tonight.
Okay, thanks a lot. Good. Okay.
So at least now we know his favorite quote from Princess Bride.
Yeah, I thought that would be short and he'd have an answer to it. So since I only had three questions, I didn't want to ask him a question that he was like, I don't know the answer to. So I thought those were safe ones.
Well, and his view on LBJ, he's answered that question a lot, but I think he gave a little different angle when you asked him. And you know, he made it very clear he was not a big Johnson fan, but now that he's been in politics and understands the negotiations and the trade-offs that happen in regular politics, he has a better appreciation of Johnson. But he read the book that was written by Doris Kearns Goodwin, a famed historian, I should say, who has written books about many presidents. And when he said when he read that book, he really got a better appreciation for where Johnson came from. Johnson, here's a man who taught very poor children in his Hispanic area of Texas, learned what real poverty was, being around those kids, seeing how they had to live, which led to his concern about poverty as president. And he was a segregationist as a member of the House of the Senate. He was from Texas. He was from the South. He becomes president, and he becomes a great champion for civil rights. I think that's the basic story he was trying to tell in this film.
Oh, yeah. I mean, before we jump into the review, one thing I wanted to say about Rob Reiner.
Please, go ahead.
So I was staying with my wife after the screening, and she was like, I recognize Rob Reiner from something, because he acts too. I mean, he's a director, but he has more acting credits than he has directing credits. And you may have recognized him, of course, All in the Family. He looks very different from then, but he was, of course, on that TV show. He's made, you know, bit appearances in a lot of TV shows. He was in Wolf of Wall Street as Leonardo DiCaprio's father in that. And I started listing things that he acted in. She was like, no, no, no. And then I finally said, oh, he played Jess's dad on the TV show New Girl. That's where I know him from. And so it was exactly where she... And he was pretty funny on that show.
Well, no, he's a very good actor. No question about that. His father was a great actor and comedy writer, as we heard. But I think his talent, his big talent, is directing. I mean, my goodness, you're right. You really chimed down on all the different films that people remember that he directed. And so we're going to get it. Anything else you want to add before
we go? Let's jump in the review.
I want to talk about LBJ. And I must say, I've seen a lot about LBJ, you know, All the Way, which was Bryan Cranston's portrayal of LBJ.
Did you see Selma, too?
Was an HBO film. I saw Selma as well. And his character, it was Martin Luther King and he interacting together, which really isn't, they don't zero in on that in this film.
But he's a prominent character in that, too.
Oh, yes, he was definitely a prominent character in Selma. Had a lot to do with what happened there. So I think of Bryan Cranston when I think of LBJ. He successfully portrayed him on Broadway and was to much acclaim.
He won a Tony and was nominated for an Emmy for it. So, yeah, he really spent a lot of time working on that character.
So you think of Bryan Cranston, who's been successful in everything he's done. But now we have Woody Harrelson playing LBJ, and I thought, how in the world is this going to work? And I know that there's been a lot of questions asked of Rob Reiner, why did you choose Woody Harrelson? The basic answer is he's a great actor. Whatever role he's given, he always comes through. By the way, you'll hear some sirens. We are right next to the sidewalk and Main Street here in downtown Carmel, so you get to hear the sounds of the city as we record this podcast. But it wasn't just Woody Harrelson. He did a great job. At his wife, Lady Bird, was played by Jennifer Jason Leigh. And he talked about how in the question and answer session, which we're going to show, we'll be playing a little bit of that later if you want to hear it. But Jennifer Jason Leigh was a perfect, I thought, choice to play Lady Bird. Another prominent character, the wife of Lyndon Johnson.
She's a great actress. I remember her from one of my favorite 80s films, Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Oh, my goodness. That goes back a ways.
And she hadn't done as much recently. Let me wait for this.
Sure.
But, you know, she just got an Oscar nomination for The Hateful Eight, a Quentin Tarantino movie. So she's getting a little bit of a comeback, and she was really good in this role.
One person that I had forgotten about in history, and I try to be a bit of a history buff myself, was Ralph Yarbrough, who was a senator from Texas, while Lyndon Johnson was the other senator from Texas. And Yarbrough had a reputation for being more on the liberal side than Johnson did during his Senate career, anyway. And that was played masterfully by Bill Pullman, where he and Yarbrough, I'm talking about Lyndon Johnson and Yarbrough, were at odds with each other. That once Johnson became president, Yarbrough was one of his greatest allies, how things change in politics so quickly. And there are a lot of other people who were in the film, but I'm going to ask you just to quickly say that what Rob Reiner did in this film was take this whole situation. They're going to Dallas in 1963. Johnson is there. They begin with that and what all happened with the assassination of John Kennedy and go forward a few years with many flashbacks to him being Senate Majority Leader, the campaign of 1960 where he lost to Kennedy and then became the vice presidential candidate. So you go back and forth, and that's always a danger in a film when you do these flashbacks and go back to the time period, but you're trying to zero in on. So it really dealt with the assassination and some of the time after that and flashbacks to a few years before. That's the time period that Rob Reiner is concentrating on in this film, LBJ. So, Adam, your thoughts on the film?
So it's kind of a hard film to review because I knew so much about the story. Obviously, I didn't live through it, but I did see All the Way. I've, you know, seen a lot of stuff about the Kennedys in general. I've seen many portrayals of JFK in the last 10 years. I also saw the Selma, the Ava DuVernay film that focused on Martin Luther King and the Selma protests, where Tom Wilkinson played LBJ. Now, I felt that in the Bryan Cranston HBO movie and in Tom Wilkinson's portrayal, Selma, you saw versions of LBJ that weren't very flattering. In Selma, it appears as if they don't really want to give him very much credit for the Voting Rights Act.
And there are people who worked for Johnson who were very concerned about the portrayal in that film. Yes.
They were upset. And then Bryan Cranston's version, it was more complicated. He wasn't a bad guy. He did a lot of great things. But it showed that as a leader, he would be cutthroat. There was a lot more F-bombs in that version. And it was kind of a grittier, darker version where he was just obsessed with trying to get stuff done and would do whatever it takes. That's why All the Way is kind of the title of the film, to get things done. Now, both those films focus on very different time periods. They'll focus on after he was elected and while he's trying to kind of enact the civil rights legislation. The HBO film had a prominent character, Hubert Humphrey, played by Bradley Whitford from West Wing, doesn't even appear in this film. Because this film, not to give anything away, somewhat ends shortly after he takes office following the Kennedy assassination. And there's kind of a scroll at the end that fills you in all the other things he's done. But they really wanted to shorten the scope of the movie. They couldn't do his entire life story, which I kind of appreciate. If you look at Oliver Stone's Nixon, I feel like that didn't need to go from cradle to grave in that kind of film.
Although he tried in some ways.
I know. Yeah. It's... So, Oliver Stone can never edit himself down.
I like Nixon. It was a long film, but I'm not going to belabor that point. So go, please.
Yeah. So this film takes an interesting scope. If I were to say where Rob Reiner focused on, and he didn't write the screenplay, but I'm sure he had a say in it as a director, kind of what to focus on. They focused on the kind of getting out of the Kennedy shadow and kind of proving himself as a leader. And there's some themes that keep put in there. Now, Kennedy was probably our first television president. He was very loved. He was very handsome. That's part of the reason he beat Richard Nixon on television, because it was the first televised presidential debates, and he looked calm and confident and young on TV, and Richard Nixon was sweating with a 5 o'clock shadow.
And the interesting part of that is the people who listened to that debate on radio said Nixon won.
And then
people
on television,
on TV, Kennedy won.
And Johnson, probably one of the most powerful Senate majority leaders for the Democrats that they've ever had. He was a deal maker. He could get things done. So he thought, I'm a shoo-in for the presidency. But the Kennedys, they had the charisma and they were loved. And so in the film, they often repeat the theme of, why don't they love me? Johnson wanted to be loved. He wanted people to like him the same way they liked Kennedy. And there's this conflict between him and RFK. As many might know from history, Bobby Kennedy, he had his eyes on the White House too. And there's even a part where he says, you're not worried about what will happen to me on the ticket next term. You want to make me politically irrelevant so I can't run in 1968, because you, as Attorney General, Bobby, you're thinking of running in 68, which... he did, but as
well,
we know,
much different circumstances.
Yeah, he did. After Johnson decided not to run, and of course, Bobby Kennedy wasn't able to finish his campaign because he was unfortunately assassinated, just like his brother. So this was tough, because you look at all the history. You had these darker versions. I will say this: this version of LBJ is a much kinder version of LBJ. Now, Rob Reiner himself said in the post interview that LBJ's daughter saw the screening and really liked it. She said, that's the man I knew. And so, for many ways, that's a positive for the film. This is a portrayal that the family themselves say is accurate. But another way, that also shows this is kind of the cleaner, safer version of LBJ. This isn't the F-bombs. This isn't the darkness. This isn't the cutthroat. There was a little bit of that. I mean, they didn't...
Well, he did have one meeting with his staff while he was on the toilet. He was famous
yes.
for that.
Yeah, he was famous yeah. for that. But this is kind of, maybe... the more family-friendly LBJ, so to speak. So I really enjoyed the film, but I think some of that might have, colored it a little bit for me. And I'll say one criticism of the movie, and I really liked it, but I thought there were some parts in the screenplay that were very much tell, not show. For example, when a character would say, he just wants to be loved, or when he says, why don't they like me? I mean, I get that. That was part of it. But as a viewer, I usually like a little more subtlety, where instead of just telling me exactly what's in the character's mind, we can you know, discern it through their acting. So that kind of irked me a bit as a writer. And then I've heard mixed things. I actually looked at some reviews online how people felt about the prosthetics that Woody Harrelson had to put on to play the role. He had a kind of a chin, he had the ears, and he had the nose, and he had some kind of jowl lines. Because Woody Harrelson's fairly young, a lot younger than Bryan Cranston. Some people thought it limited his facial mobility, and some felt it to be distracting. I could see that. It really didn't bother me that much, but there were moments where I was looking at his ears and nose. And as a viewer, you really don't want to be focusing on that as much. If I give an overall grade, it's going to be somewhere between a C to a B minus. So some people think, oh, that's terrible. No, that's not terrible. I still enjoyed the film. I just don't think it's a best picture worthy film.
Yeah, I've said a C minus and above. I say go see it. The gradations are in between. And I'm not saying don't go see it if it's C minus. That just means it's got some flaws. You mentioned the screenplay, and the screenplay was written by Joey Hartstone. And I went back and looked at his credits. He's almost entirely been a television writer before. I think this is his first feature film, as best I can ascertain. He's worked on some documentary films. I think he's a good writer, but I think the fact that this is his first feature film shows a little bit. It's not bad screenplay. It's just not top-notch screenplay. I'm not going to disagree much with you. I would give it a B overall. I do not think this will be one of Rob Reiner's best films. It's not Princess Bride. It's not When Harry Met Sally and Stand By Me and all the other films that I'm not mentioning that were very good that he's done. But it's a good film. It's not going to be one of his outstanding films. And it goes back to something you've already said, that they were very kind to LBJ in this film. And I understand that was his idea. Now, Reiner himself made it very clear that when he started this project, he hated LBJ. And the reason, and I'm pretty close to his age, in the 1960s when you were growing up, especially in the late 60s, everybody wanted to know, what's your draft status? You know, I was looking for jobs in radio, and people wanted to know, what's your draft status? That was the big question of the day. So, you know, people didn't like Johnson because the draft calls were getting higher and higher. More and more people were being drafted. So I don't think he liked Johnson to begin with. Then he really researched him, read a book about him, as I mentioned earlier, and found some things about him that he never really thought much about. So I think he went from being, boy, this was a horrible guy that put us into a war that was very unpopular. All true. But he did some other things that we still are seeing today. So my view on this is it's a B film, not the best film that Rob Reiner has ever done. He was pretty soft on Johnson. I think his idea is, this is Lyndon Johnson. This is the man I read about in Doris Kearns Goodwin's book. This is the Lyndon Johnson that his daughter said that she remembered. But is it the Lyndon Johnson that we really need to know? So the question there is, as a history buff, I enjoyed the film. I would have liked a little more. But I think Reiner did what he set out to do. And that was to give us a little more insight into this man, where he came from, how difficult it was to take over a country after a horrible assassination of a very popular president who was young and good-looking. And here's this old, you know, deal-making guy who's got a history of being a segregationist, who's got a history of being a Texas senator, and there's not much of a record as vice president, and now he assumes the presidency. This was a pretty scary time for him, and that did come through in the film.
It's hard to do films based on historical events because not only are you judged on the quality of the film itself, as if it were just complete fiction, you know, you have the idea of how was the cinematography, how was the acting, how was the makeup, how was the story, how did it flow? But on top of all of that, when you're basing it on a true story, you have to worry about how accurate was it? How did it portray the events? And so in that event, I don't know, I think the accuracy was pretty good. I thought they focused on some different things. As a film, it's good. It didn't break any new ground. I look at a film like Jackie that came out last year with Natalie Portman. That film had some beautiful cinematography, some great music, some great acting performances. But I know some people were kind of upset with the betrayal.
That was more of an emotional film than this one. This is more of a, here is Lyndon Johnson, this is the man. Jackie was more like, here's my emotional roller coaster of what I've had to deal with in life. So I think that these films came from a completely different direction. And Jackie was probably a little bit better film than this one, I think. But they're both good.
I know we got to move on, but quickly, I just want to say that Heartland Film did a great job putting on the event. And I maybe liked the film more, too, because of what a great atmosphere it was. The staff put on a great job. I also made sure to pay attention because who was sitting right in front of me? Rob Reiner. So I kind of joked my wife.
He sat in front of you as well.
Yes, he was sitting right in front of us during the movie. So if I fell asleep or something, that wouldn't have looked good. But I wouldn't have done that anyways. I was never bored during this movie. It was good. And Heartland, if you have a chance, I know a lot of their shows are sold out.
They are.
So I recommend if you want to see one of their movies, get on the website and buy the tickets ahead of time. Because if you just show up to the theater, they might have a few spots. But I think they're having a record number of sellouts for this year.
And it's because this film festival has now been around for 26 years, and it started out as kind of a down-the-middle vanilla kind of festival. You know, you were safe. These were neat, nice, neat stories, but they've gone beyond that now. They're willing to take chances. We talked about that with Richard Probst when he was here, that Heartland is willing to take chances, and they're willing to be a little bit on the edge, and they've shown that this year, which brings me to an event you couldn't attend because you had other business to attend to. But on the following night after opening night, there was a critics panel. Chaz Ebert was the moderator. Chaz Ebert, if you don't know who she is the widow of Roger Ebert. I grew up with film criticism, reading and watching Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert. They were on television. That's how I got to know them. And outstanding film critics, both of them. And Roger Ebert certainly was a legendary film critic. The film that she put together, this I think it's called "This Is My Life,"
and it was Life Itself.
Excuse me. It was screened yesterday. I'd seen it before, but there was another screening yesterday. But Chaz Ebert produced that film. Excellent film on the life of Roger Ebert. Just outstanding. Then they had this panel discussion about film criticism. They had, and I cannot think of his name. It's the German reviewer. Mm-hmm. Who sat next to Chaz. And then there was Christopher Lloyd, who has been on one of my podcasts last year when my regular podcasts wanted to do a Christmas show, didn't want to do anything serious. So we talked about movies for, 40 minutes. He's a fascinating guy. And Richard Probst was also there, who was our guest just recently on this program. Here are a couple of things that came out of that. Number one is in Europe, there is a difference between a reviewer and a critic. If you're a critic, it's like you are. It's your view of the film. If you're a reviewer, you're just sort of explaining to people what the film's about and putting a little angle on it. That's sort of what I, mm-hmm. I got from it. And one thing that Chaz Ebert said that I think is very interesting is that at the Cannes Film Festival, the biggest film festival in the world, I think without dispute, newspapers are still very big in France. They really haven't gone down as they have here in terms of their ability to continue to sustain daily newspapers. So if you are a film critic and you work for a newspaper, you get the very best credential at Cannes. It gets you in any film you want to see, which is a big deal there. People can't get into every film. The other thing I was going to mention is that there was a discussion in some of the question and answer about who does a film critic write to. In other words, are you writing from your own self, or are you writing for your audience? Who are you writing this criticism for? And they had various answers. I can give you my answer, and I'd like to hear yours. My view is I'm writing on my impressions of the film with the audience in mind. I don't write for the audience. I don't write for me. I look at the film and try to evaluate it, but I think about how it would impact the audience. Great example is what we just recently reviewed. You know, I think some films are really great, but the audience is going to have trouble understanding it, for example. So my view is you do both. Do you think you write for yourself, or do you write for your audience, or is it a mix?
It's more of the audience. Mine's a utilitarian purpose, where I think someone wants to look at the review, kind of figure out whether or not they want to see this movie or not. So a lot of times I'll avoid spoilers, which if I was writing to an audience that's already seen the film, it kind of might be more fun sometimes because you could really analyze it. I could say, if you look at this scene and this is what happened, and this is really what it meant. Sometimes that might be more fun, but I know 90% of the people that I'm writing this to have not seen the film. They just want to know, should they go see it? And so sometimes, too, when we're on the podcast or when I'm writing something on Facebook to let people know about a movie, I'll say, you know what, I really liked it, but if you like these films, maybe it's not for you. For example, the film Columbus, you know, me and you both loved it, but I'm not going to recommend it to every single person because some people it might be too slow or too boring. So I really try to let people know this is who this film is for. The same when it comes to Mother, which I know the audience for that is very small. So I'm like, I'm telling most people don't see that. And with LBJ, I think to let people know, this film, I think a lot of people will really like. I think if you're someone who likes, if you're a big Tarantino person, if you're someone who likes, you know, darker, grittier movies, more of the artsy films, if you loved Mother, maybe you're going to feel that LBJ is too safe. But, you know, that's not most people. And that's the thing that I think a lot of film critics forget. Sometimes they give movies bad reviews and it's just a fun action movie and they say, oh, it was mindless, it had no point, it had no meaning. But the audience score, if you look on Rotten Tomatoes, is much higher than the critics score because they really enjoyed it. So there are some film critics that are out of touch with the average audience member and what they would enjoy in a film.
Yeah, you and I think, work very hard. Sometimes we slip, but we try very hard not to give away too much of the film. We explain it as best we can, the basic plot, the basic story, which is out there anyway, and talk about aspects of the film. But we don't want to give away the really important plot twist, or certainly not the ending. And Chaz Ebert said that's one of her pet peeves. There are too many critics, particularly the online critics, who just lay the whole film out for you. I don't think you're doing the audience a great bit of... you're not benefiting.
But there's room to have. So I see one website, they'll have a thing called the spoiler space where they'll discuss a review for people who've seen it already. And that can be really fun because you can go into a lot of different things.
Yeah, but if, you know, I don't know, people are going to be really tempted to go to that even if they've...
Well, that's on them, Larry. That's on them. If they have to resist the temptation.
One other thing I'll mention about that, that you and I have talked about this before, and I was really interested in how these critics said that. Somebody asked them, do you read other reviews and critics before you see a film? And you know my policy. Mm-hmm. I do my best. Every now and then I can't help it. But in most cases, I try not to read or know Rotten Tomatoes scores or some of these other scores that are out there before I see the film. Then I sit down and write my notes or make my mental notes. Then I will read some of the other critics. And that had always been the standard for these, the old style critics who wrote for newspapers and maybe some magazines, that kind of thing. But what I heard on that stage at this seminar was that that's changing, particularly with some of the online people, that they don't really seem to care. They'll go ahead and they will go ahead and read the reviews before they even see the film that they're reviewing. I still prefer to get my own impression beforehand before I read reviews. But that was the old standard. Don't look at a review until you've seen the film and at least started writing or made notes about it. Now it's open.
I think it's okay.
It's open out here.
As long as you really have some discipline to not let other people's opinions influence yours. Mm-hmm. And I'll go into a movie and I'll hear a bunch of reviews, or now Twitter, everyone can put a one sentence thing about what they thought about a film. And people say, this is amazing. This is the greatest film ever. And I really, in my head, try not to let that build my expectations up, because you could end up hating a movie or thinking, oh, that wasn't that good. Well, why didn't you enjoy it? Well, everyone said it was the greatest film ever. And I saw it. It wasn't the best movie ever made. I'm like, well, okay,
you're setting up an impossible standard.
It was still fun. It was still good. I'm sorry you let it get overhyped for you, but I try not to let my mind go there.
All right, anything else about The Heartland before we have one last thing to talk about?
No, but please go. I think I'm going to probably try to go to at least four or five things next week. I'll go to the closing night ceremony, which will be the Sunday after next week's podcast. We'll get to discuss that.
Sure.
But I think there's about three films I'll see between now and our next podcast.
Very good. I want to mention one more thing before we finish, and that's Harvey Weinstein. Now, for those of you who don't know who Harvey Weinstein is and why this is such a big story, Harvey Weinstein is one of the most respected producers in Hollywood. He's also based in New York. He has been behind some of the outstanding films that we've seen. Almost every year he has had an Oscar nominee for Best Picture, most years. However, in recent years, he's had a bit of a problem. He hasn't had a hit film or really well-reviewed or outstanding film in a while. But Harvey Weinstein was somebody who could make you or break you in that business in Hollywood. A very, very powerful man. The Weinstein Company was his company. I mean, he was not the sole owner, but he was certainly the person who ran the business with his brother and several other people.
He was originally Miramax, right?
Originally, it was Miramax. So if you think about Miramax, that's now the Weinstein Company, or Weinstein. I don't know how you pronounce it. It's been pronounced both ways. But Harvey was always the man behind it. His brother Rob was always kind of in the background, a part of the company, and they had other people who were owners. I bring all that up because it had apparently been an open secret among some high-level people in Hollywood that Mr. Weinstein had a problem. Now, we don't know what the facts are, and everyone is innocent until proven guilty, and the man has not been charged criminally at all, so we all have to mention those things. But there have been some serious allegations printed in the New York Times and in the New Yorker magazine about what Mr. Weinstein has done in terms of sexual harassment. He has stepped down from the company as a result of that. So I think this goes all the way back to Louis B. Mayer when they started the Motion Picture Academy, because the Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences has always had a problem dealing with this. If you look at the history of the motion picture business, that's why Mr. Weinstein is still a member of the Academy. They can't figure out what to do with this situation. So I just want to say a few words, and I want to get your reaction. The two or three things that really strike me about this. Number one, this has all come out when he's not as powerful as he was before, which is interesting. People have known that there's something going on there. We don't know what, but those rumors have been around for a long time. There have been reporters who have been trying to report on it, and nobody could ever get the story, the facts, to the point where an editor would let it appear in a major publication. So we know that. Here's the part that I really irks me about this, because we've had people on both sides of the political spectrum who have been involved in this. We have Roger Ailes, who started and made Fox News a big operation, who sadly passed away after he stepped down in an accident. Then we have now we have Weinstein. You know, Ailes was on the right side of the political equation. Weinstein has always contributed to Democrats, tended to support liberal causes. What really bothers me is I'm a guy with twin daughters who are in their 20s. I have a wife. I have the daughters. I have sisters. I have cousins and nieces and people that I know. I would never want any of those people treated the way that Weinstein is alleged to have treated people in these news reports. I don't think this is a partisan issue. You know, I don't think liberals should be gleeful when Roger Ailes is doing it. I don't think conservatives should be gleeful because Weinstein did this. I wish we would have a consensus and leave the politics out of it, and everybody say, this is not the way you treat human beings. This is not the way to treat people in any kind of business. So that's my speech.
I was about to say the exact same thing. I 100% agree. There was some glee on the Republican side when this came out, saying, finally, we got one of theirs, because they've been going after our people like Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly for years. But then some of the Democrats, when their response was a little bit defensive, saying, well, what about that Trump? He's had some accusations himself, too. Look over here. None of that really matters right now. What we really need to look at is, this isn't something that's just happening in Hollywood. Yes, Hollywood is a perfect example where this is a hotbed issue because it is so competitive to become an actress today in a major film that some of them may feel pressured to do something they don't feel comfortable doing because it is such a cutthroat industry. But this happens here in Indianapolis, here in completely other fields where someone says, hey, if you want to get ahead in this job, you need to go on a date with so-and-so, or you need to hang out with so-and-so on a date, or you can't offend him. He's a partner at the law firm. So we really have to take a stand against this. And it's not just on women to speak out on this issue. We as men need to support them. We need to speak out when we see it happen. And I'll say it too, there are men who are victims of sexual harassment, and we're seeing it in this Harvey Weinstein case. Terry Crews, a prominent actor, said that he had another male try to fondle him, and he didn't say anything because the guy was powerful and he wants to still work in Hollywood. So anyone can become a victim here. We all have to join together, and we have to resist the temptation to make this a partisan issue.
This is a matter of human respect. And that I think we just need to have a consensus that we all need to make sure that this ends. And when we find it, we want to make sure it's investigated and that people face the consequences if there are there's evidence that somebody has done something illegal or could be civilly held liable for it.
And I know people like to make jokes about something like this when it happens. I've heard, oh, this is a PG podcast, people making jokes about a certain potted plant. If you've read a little bit about what happened there, I won't go into it. But I'm going to say this. Jokes are fine, but let's not turn this into a laughing matter. This is a serious issue, and this is one that's gone on way too long.
Okay. We've said our piece on that. Harvey Weinstein has made that a discussion again. So let's hope we're moving in the right direction. I keep hoping, but the time will tell. And yes, let's hope other people agree with us. We have a little added treat for you here in just a moment. I did a little experiment. You were sitting next to Rob Reiner. Behind him, I was sitting way in the back of the auditorium when I was watching LBJ at the opening ceremony. And I did try to use the same recording machine that I used to record your interview with Rob Reiner to see if I could pick it up off the speaker. So we've got a few minutes of Rob Reiner's question and answer. It was Christy Lee of Q95 and Greg Sorvig of the Heartland Film Festival, who we know, talking with Rob Reiner after the film. So we're going to play a little of that. It's not the best quality, but I think you can hear it fine. And then we'll end the show up and do the close after that. Anything you want to add before we go, Adam?
No.
Well, have a great week. We'll be back again next week with Hamilton County Goes to the Movies. Our podcast originates from Donatello's Italian Restaurant, 9 West Main Street in downtown Carmel. Check out the menu at donatellositalian.com or call them 317-564-4790. If you enjoy our podcasts, spread the word with links on social media. Also, comment on our podcasts on iTunes. Search by typing in this phrase, Hamilton County Goes to the Movies, and do that in the iTunes search box. Now, on to this week's guest.
We have today's guest with us, Dan Cavallini. He is the producer and cinematographer on Homecoming, a short film made right here in Indiana that is premiering at the Heartland Film Festival. It's the premiere, right? It's the first time anyone's seen it in a theater?
No, this is not. We had our first premiere at the Alhambra Theater Film Festival.
Okay.
The film actually got Best Cinematic Short. So we don't have the Indiana premiere, unfortunately. That would have been nice.
It's still pretty exciting because it's part of the Indiana Shorts. There's actually two series of Indiana Shorts here at the Heartland Film Festival. There's a part one and a part two, and this is in the part two block. And I believe there's three showings, and are they all sold out?
They are. We had the first showing yesterday, the second is on Monday, and then the third is on Tuesday.
Well, regardless of the fact that it's sold out, I'm sure there'll be plenty of opportunities for people to see it, so we kind of wanted to talk about this really, really pretty amazing short film that me and Larry were given the opportunity to see a screener of, and we both were really impressed.
Thank you.
Yes, I really want to talk about a couple of things. And we mentioned this earlier before we started recording. The restaurant where a lot of this film is shot is one of my mother's favorite restaurants, right along Pendleton Pike. She lives in Oak Landon, mm-hmm. and it's right there in Lawrence. And you clearly had a lot of cooperation from the city of Lawrence, from R2 owns. It's an independently owned restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
So tell me, I guess we're going to talk a lot about the film, but before I do that, how do you and your group of people choose the places where you shoot these scenes?
Number one is availability. you take what you can get, and then you work around it. We knew Art. He had been a good friend of the city administration with Mayor Jessup when he was in office there. Bruce Northern, who is also a producer on Homecoming, was the DPW director for the city of Lawrence. A lot of close ties, personal friendships, and we were able to use that to request permission to film in some of these locations. In fact, the home scene where we had the flashbacks to, one of our locations actually fell apart at the last minute. That home is actually owned by Sharon Franklin, who is a City of Lawrence councilor. And she was gracious enough to allow us to use her home to film for an afternoon. So that was really nice. And just, you know, building those relationships and having that available and people to come out and help you was really nice.
I want to talk about the story. Tell me how that story came together. I don't want to give away too much because sure. I want people to be able to see the film and enjoy it. But just tell us a little bit about how this, I'll just say briefly, it has to do with a country music star who's coming back home and tries to deal with his past by going to the funeral of someone he was once close to. I'll just put it that way. So tell me how that whole story came about, how you and the people writing this film came up with that idea.
Bruce Northern was the screenwriter for Homecoming, and he worked with me on several shorts before, and we were talking and running through some ideas, and I basically told him, I said, give me a story, put together a story, something that we can do in about, you know, 10 or 12 minutes. This one turned out to be 20, but give me a story and let's build on that. And Bruce is also a musician and has a lot of roots within the music industry, with folk artists in particular. And so he was able to put together the story, and it's a culmination of, you know, individuals that he knows or he's aware of, and common situations that you see, you know, within that industry. So we took that, built it around the concept of a recording artist who, you know, is now coming back to their roots, a little bit of redemption. And being able to kind of take in everything that they either took for granted or they forgot or they cut ties to, and kind of making that come around full circle. And just to kind of really bring back the humanity a little bit of the characters. So I think we succeeded on that.
Well, I think so, too. And I think that the whole idea of family, which is at the heart of so many scripts that you see, that the idea of family is also at the center of your story.
It is, and it's family and close relationships and childhood friendships that grew and you know, over time and into adulthood. And, you know, people change after a while. You know, the friends that you have 20 years ago, you might be able to count on one hand with fingers left over how many of them you still talk to. And so you have a little bit of that element as well. And it's one of those things, too, is where, you know, people, they move away from their hometowns, they move away from their friends, they come back. And usually what happens is that the person coming back has changed, everyone else has stayed the same. And so we had that little bit of an element in there as well. So we wanted to kind of hit on these things, but do it within a short category. So as not to let it run too long.
Well, before I get to my next question, I want to brag a little bit about some of the cast and the people involved with the film. We are a Hamilton County-based podcast, and there's a lot of Hamilton County people involved in this film. Bruce Northern is Geist. Mm-hmm. Amy Pozek, who was our second guest ever on our podcast, is a producer on the film. And I think there's a lot of other people that are, you're from Noblesville yourself, right. And there's a lot of different people here in both the Indianapolis area and in Hamilton County involved with this film. Interestingly enough, though, and I got to say this because I have a little personal connection, besides Amy, and Amy's a friend, Brian Boyd.
Yeah.
I went to high school with Brian.
Really?
Yes, North Central High School. And we were in the radio TV program together. I think we both had radio shows at the high school. And I remember once, well, first off, it was kind of funny. There was two Brian Boyds by the same name, and I was friends with both of them. So we kind of had to find a way to distinguish them. So he was the white Brian Boyd, because you couldn't call someone else the other, you know, you couldn't do that. That would be offensive. So he was, they're both our friends. They're both great guys. And I remember once I went to, this was kind of funny, a Steve Miller Band concert with Brian Boyd
at
Deer Creek. Terrible show, but if you know Brian, he made it entertaining. So
of course,
yeah. So it was kind of funny seeing him because he didn't act in high school. He wasn't in high school plays, and I've actually noticed that because I went to a big high school, North Central. We have some people in our high school who've gone on to do some big acting things. They weren't the people who did the school plays. Sometimes the people who did the school plays, some of them went on to do things, but you know. A lot of times people who don't realize that they're, you know, good at acting can just kind of discover it later on in life.
Yeah.
I don't know if he was that way, but he really does have a talent watching that. So
he was a blast to work with.
And tell a little bit about his character.
And Mark by the way, Mark Nash, our director, is a Carmel resident. Mm-hmm. So another Hamilton County connection. Mm-hmm. Brian's character, one of the things as we were putting the script together is I already had in my mind who I wanted to play these different parts. And we modeled it around some of their personalities, because that's one of the things too. Is like Matt Chrisman, who is the other lead character, opposite of Brian Boyd.
He's the country music.
He's a country music star, and they were both in an acting class with Indie Actors Academy that's put on by Jim Doherty, and so I would actually go out to Jim's class, and Jim I've worked with on other films, but I would actually sit back and just observe. And a lot of times the actors did not know what I was doing, but they were all auditioning for me. But Brian and Matt both just had this certain just inner quality that just really fit that part. They could pull it off. And we made the perfect casting choices there. And Brian just could, I mean, he could bring it. He would get into character, he'd stay in character and push it through. And a lot of times, even during film breaks, it's very important to keep the continuity of the character going.
So he stayed in character?
And a lot of times, you know, if they start to fall out of character, I would say something that was the hot button for that character to keep them in character. And, you know, a lot of times we create tension just in between, or we separate them out. So if we have two adversarial characters and personalities, when we're done with the scene, we don't want them out grabbing a smoke or grabbing something to drink and chit-chatting with each other. I'm going to keep them separated because I don't want to lose that tension. But with Brian's character especially, I mean, he really pulled off him and Matt both pulled off beautiful
scenes.
He
did a great job. It was funny. Again, it was my first time seeing him act in anything, and I was very impressed. So he was really good. Now, when I saw the film, it's only about 20 minutes long.
Correct.
But, and I say this as a compliment, after watching it, I thought, well, this could have been a feature-length movie. There's some potential here with the kind of story and the relationships. There's a lot you could have delved into, which I think is a good thing, because if the film ends and it leaves people wanting more, you did a good job.
Exactly, thank you.
is it tough, though, doing a short film to kind of pick and choose what to include and not to go over time?
Yeah, it's a struggle to make sure that you don't belabor something, you know, because one of the things that you look at is are we forcing an idea down the throat of the audience where they're going to be sitting, yes, I've got it, I understand, let's move on to the next piece, but not throwing away too much to where they're wondering, how do I piece A and B together to come to where we're at right now? We left a lot of scenes on the floor, as it were, but it is a little bit you can get away with a little bit more in a short film just because of the compression of time, but it's finding that balance. As I think I've watched this film probably a couple hundred times at least, and you know, going back and forth, do we want to bring this scene in, do we want to extend it out, do we want to shorten the other one, does it match? Does it flow into the next? Does it flow into the overall story? Is it gonna get across the message that we want? And one of the key things with that we do before we lock the film down is we will watch the entire film several times, and we'll turn off the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And the test is, can we follow the story, put it together without any dialogue? Because we're visual learners. We're 94, you know, our learning process is 94% visual. And if we have that, the dialogue just adds to it, and it enhances the experience and the story.
Yeah, it's very interesting you say that. The cinematography, just the expressions on the actors' faces, their movements, communicate a lot. It's not just the dialogue, although that's important. I want to ask you about something you mentioned earlier. You said you started off with a 10 or 12-minute film idea,
mm-hmm.
ended up with 20 minutes with a lot on the cutting room floor with that. Tell me how that process works.
It's a process that works great with a lot of Tylenol and caffeine. We start off with a core idea. So there'll be a script treatment written, which is usually about a page long, and it just gives an overall synopsis. And then we build into it from there. We do a lot of table reads. We bounce it off of people that we know and see, okay, what's working, what's not, and just a lot of finesse. So it's a pretty long process, and I'm one of those cinematographers where I want to try to get as much coverage as possible. And even at the end of the day, when the film's in the can, you still go back and you think, God, I wish I would have gotten this one shot. Mm-hmm. And you know, so you're always second guessing yourself, but I try to get as much coverage because working with my friend Jim Doherty, who is a SAG actor, he's a director, and he's also a very good editor. He edited our film. Is I have to put myself in his shoes as an editor to shoot it as I would think he would cut it. So it's something that editors usually appreciate, having a lot of material to work with and to go back and forth on. But that was one of the things I learned from Jim on my very first short that I filmed that I didn't even finish. We finished the filming of it. We didn't finish the editing because I made so many mistakes on it.
Oh, gotcha.
But I learned from it because I got the critique from people I trust that have done this for a long time. Jim being one of them is this worked, this didn't. You want to look out for this, and it was almost like mentoring, and so I take all the critiques to heart on everything that I do and try to improve. The next film, I want to be better than this one, and so on and so forth.
Adam and I can speak for myself. I think Adam agrees. I'm a big fan of short films. I've always enjoyed short films. And I think one thing I like about them is that you really have to move the story along. There's a beginning, middle, and an end, but you don't have time to wander. Adam and I, the film I saw right before seeing yours was Blade Runner 2049, which was 2 hours and 44 minutes long.
Yeah.
So I'm comparing the two, not to say anything about Blade Runner. It had its own, had its own story. But I just thought to myself, wow, look at these people. They took a great story and told it in 20 minutes.
What I love about short films, too, is sometimes you can explore ideas that maybe couldn't be expanded to a feature-length film. Now, yours obviously could be. There's a lot of potential material there. But it's just like reading short stories in a book. Mm-hmm. I was growing up a fan of Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah.
And I noticed Kurt Vonnegut would sometimes take an idea, and he liked the idea, but it wasn't worth a whole book, so he'd do a little short story. Or sometimes he would take his alter ego, Kilgore Trout, the science fiction writer, and he would just throw out the idea in like a paragraph, and that's it. But that's okay, because sometimes there's something worth... you want to play with the idea, you want to explore it. It would be great for 20 minutes, but if you had to sit through, it's kind of like those SNL sketches. You remember?
Yes, yeah.
They're funny in 3-4 minute sketches, but when they make, the cheerleaders movie or whatever the Night at the Roxbury, you're like, okay, that didn't work 90 minutes. You should have kept it to the 3 minute
thing. But Wayne's World did work.
Yeah, it did work because...
It's one of the few.
Yeah, it did work. I did like Wayne's World. So we really enjoyed Homecoming, but tell us about your background, how you got your start, and some of the other films you've worked on.
Yeah, and just to quickly dovetail off what you said about the shorts, there's several reasons why we do the shorts. Number one is to put forth a film idea and concept that you want to create and build. It's much lower budget than, say, shooting a feature. But also, too, is that gives you an opportunity to try out new crew, new actors, new locations, and story ideas that you may want to cultivate into a feature-length film, depending upon how it's received. So there's a number of reasons to do a short that you can kind of experiment with. It's a lot different to do a 3-day shoot with some new folks or you're testing out and a full 21-day shoot feature-length film where people can start getting on each other's nerves a little bit. my background is I was... The artistic side of my brain is what I use to keep sane. I'm actually a lawyer by trade, with a background in medical research, but the artistic side, I was a stills photographer forever, still am, and I actually did my first commercial sale when I was 10, And so I've had a camera in my hand since I was about 8 years old. In fact, I can tell you exactly what it was. It was an old Century 35 Graflex that my dad had in the 1950s. And it was like a rangefinder. You couldn't just look through the eyepiece and get the focus. You had to be able to, you know, figure out all the measurements on the fly and get good at what you were doing. So I'd always done the stills. I worked on a film crew where I started off doing the stills. They needed some help with the cinematography, and I thought, okay, it shouldn't be that much of a stretch. Well, it was. It's totally different because with stills I'm shooting one frame. With the camera, I'm shooting 24 frames every second, so it's a little bit less forgiving. And you learn along the way. You just can't put the camera up on a tripod, lock it down, and say, "Okay, we're going to go for it," because then it's not appealing. It's not appetizing. It's just a blank. It's still a blank canvas. In watching some of the good cinematographers and watching other cinematographers work, and just examining what they do. When I watch a new movie that comes out, I have to watch it five times. The first time I'm looking at lighting. I'm looking how they did the lighting. Then I'm looking at the camera angles, the camera movement. How did they convey? How did they convey stress? How did they convey a warm, touching moment? How did they convey, say, a fight scene? And how did they convey a chase? How was it filmed? How was it framed? And that's the best way to learn. I watched Die Hard, the first Die Hard movie, and when Hans Gruber first encounters Bruce Willis's character. If you look at the lighting and the camera position, it's canted just a little bit at an angle with some different color blue lighting, and so it's really cool, icy lighting, but it's subtle, and you have to go back and look at these things, and that's the best thing to do, is you can read all the books, but actually working and practicing. Again, short films allow you to practice what you learn. But I keep doing the photography and the cinematography to keep the creative juices in my brain flowing.
Is it different nowadays with, say, a film like Blade Runner, which has great cinematography, probably Oscar-worthy cinematography, but it's different than cinematography 20, 30 years ago because so much of it was probably enhanced post-production. When they have the big, colorful sky, they can go back and get the right hue of orange that they want, and if there's a lot of it that's just computer alterated. Do you think that kind of changes how you view what's? I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here because you made me think about that.
It does in a way. I grew up shooting film, so I didn't even switch over to digital until the late '90s, early 2000s. I was one of the holdouts because I grew up and I learned with film and getting it right in camera and taking the notes for every frame that you shot so you can go back and look at the negatives. And with cinematography, with digital cameras, yes, it's a lot more forgiving. You can do a lot more in post. I actually played a joke on my editor one time and made sure to get it on the audio. And I said, "Oh, it's okay. We'll fix it in post," because I know that would just set him off. And because I know that would just make him climb the walls. And I did it on purpose. And he called me later when he finally heard it. And he's like, "Oh, yeah, a few choice words," but he knew I was joking with him, I think. but you want to be able to get it right in camera. I want to keep my editor's job as simple as possible. Same thing with the person who's going to be doing the color grading. I don't want them to have to go in and fix my mistakes. There's going to be mistakes, but I don't want to carelessly make them and just say, "Well, we'll just fix that in post," because it is difficult and that costs money. And when it's your wallet that's paying for the production, those little things, we'll fix it in post. Well, that just bought you $200 worth of time on the editor's table. So you try to make them count and work the lighting, let the lighting work for you. And really try to get it as right as you can, so they don't have to do a whole lot. I want somebody to go in and edit one of my films, and look more at the story and how things are gonna fold into the next scene, rather than have to worry about, oh, geez, they got another boom pole in the shot. I mean, you always get that. We had a couple shots where actually there was one shot in there. It's very subtle, but you can actually pick up just a tiny bit of the boom pole shadow. and it was just like, okay, yeah, we can't get that out of there, unfortunately. But it's one of those things like, okay, we know it's in there, and most people will not recognize it. We will, but most folks won't.
Lighting, you mentioned lighting. Lighting is one of the most underappreciated parts of filmmaking to the general public. But if you study it, it's interesting. I'll tell the first film where I really noticed the lighting, strangely enough, was in The Godfather, the first mm-hmm. Godfather film, which was very dimly lit in many of those inside scenes, particularly early in the film. And I remember hearing that Francis Ford Coppola, when the film executives saw what they call the dailies, the mm-hmm. film, the raw film they shoot that day, they were going nuts. And Francis Ford Coppola had to say, calm down. I have a reason for doing this. And of course, we all know what happened. The film was a classic. But I do think that has a lot to do with building the mood for the moment. And you're right, the camera angle, the background, the lighting, the colors in the background can change the mood. And if it's a dramatic scene, people need a signal of that.
Right.
And that's, I think, what you were talking about. My next question for you is this. This is your fourth short film, is that correct?
Fourth short film, yeah.
So do you want to produce a full-length feature film at some point?
Eventually, but it is, having worked on a full-length feature before, in fact, one that I did work on as a stills photographer, just got picked up with Showtime under Artist View Entertainment. Got the film. It's called Dead Draw, which was mostly an Indiana crew. Those are difficult. I mean, you basically have 3 weeks of shooting. Every page of a script represents about 5 minutes on the screen. All right. So I'll take that back. 1 minute. 1 minute per page. You're lucky if you can get 5 minutes shot in a day. Mm-hmm. If you can get 5 pages shot in a day, you're doing pretty good. So when you're in a movie theater and you're watching a film, every 5 minutes that ticks by was 1 day of production.
And
if
you've got a problem, it's longer than that.
It's much longer. Yeah. And definitely on a full length feature, you need to have a lot more crew. You can't wear multiple hats like you can do on a short, because you cannot sustain that heightened level of focus for longer than a couple days. You need to make sure that you do have production managers, you do have multiple producers, you have a line producer, people take care of the paperwork so you don't have to worry about it. On a short film, on a 2 or 3 day shoot, you can get away with wearing multiple hats, not on a feature. But eventually, yeah, it'd be nice to be able to produce a feature and to even, shoot quite a bit of it. I know my limitations, and I think with that kind of money, I would want to have a lot more experience under my belt before I took that on.
So I asked somebody, what does a producer do on a major motion picture? He said, make something out of nothing.
Yeah, I think the answer would be, what don't they do?
I mean, they have to come up with the money, the idea for the script, right, before they get the director, or they have to come up with the general concept.
Yeah, the executive producer on a film is, they're the ones that are either funding or they've gathered the funding for it. And then you have your film producers who are in charge of the daily admin. Then you have the line producers who are in charge of all the payroll, production manager who controls the set. So it's anything that can usually go wrong on a set, and there's a lot of things that do. The first person you look at is the producer and say, fix this, and fix it yesterday, because time is money and we can't afford to, be down for this long, because then you have actors getting fidgety and crew getting fidgety. And depending upon the set that you're shooting on, that can also introduce safety issues. Mm-hmm. Because if people are fatigued, or if they're getting tired, or they're getting antsy, that's when accidents happen, because there is a lot of activity, there's a lot of equipment, going on a set. And, that was one of the things that, even on a short film, when we actually piece it together and do all the planning, we storyboard it, we have the shot list, we have, all the crew, what they're going to be doing and so forth. We look at it from the standpoint of, this is a full feature film, and that's how we're going to run it, even though it's only going to be 3 days.
Well, I would always like to ask something at the end about films that a lot of people have seen. So as someone from a cinematography background, tell us about some of your favorite films that people may know that have really good cinematography that you appreciate.
The Godfather is definitely one that is incredible. West Wing TV series. Mm-hmm. The cinematography on that, the lighting is beautiful. I'm totally floored by the walk and talk. So I would love to be able to recreate that. That was one of the Aaron Sorkin trademarks of being able to follow somebody. In fact, they had one episode where they actually had a 4-minute long walk and talk uncut, constant.
Shot that scene beginning to end with no cutting. Right?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Straight through.
Yeah.
And you had a lot of people coming and going, different characters coming into the discussion and so forth. The camera operator just did a phenomenal job. So there's so many good ones out there. Another one that I really, really enjoyed, Princess Bride was another one. I really enjoyed the cinematography on that. I just concluded 3.5 years overseas, mm-hmm. where I was pretty much at the mercy of whatever was on the television for reruns. The Marvel series, the Avengers and Thor, the lighting on those scenes, even though you have a lot of CGI, I really enjoyed the cinematography on some of those films as well.
I want to thank you very much for joining us. I would encourage everybody, if they get the chance, to see Homecoming in whatever way you may, in a movie theater, if it comes to television or whatever else. I tell you, one of my favorite TV channels is Shorts HD. I don't know. I got that on my cable channel. Didn't even know it was on there. I started watching that. I thought, wow, this is terrific. So maybe someday you'll get a chance to get a shot at that.
I hope so. Shorts are becoming more and more popular.
Well, thank you for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Can you make sure your volume is turned up to 11?
Oh, my God. Yes. I got to make sure I don't put this on the seat.
Yeah. Don't sit on that.
You don't want to.
You know, I have this really nice, heartfelt speech written, and you just ruined it. Thanks.
Back to the heartfelt part.
Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you. That's very sweet. I mean, this is great. I mean, you know, when you get... You know, lifetime achievement says that that's the end. It's the lifetime. Because they don't give you these when you're 28. You know? So, but I hope to keep doing this, and this is very sweet. And this was an incredible response. I mean, you guys, what an amazing response. It was really, really touching. I mean, this was great. I don't know what else to say.
Well, we're going to ask some questions. Is that all right?
Yeah, you're allowed to ask questions. Okay. Should we sit down?
Sure, have a seat.
I'm going to put this.
I don't know if I can climb up that high. I may stand if that's all right.
Yeah.
I'm a little short. This might be a little rough for me.
Yeah.
First of all, when I saw the trailer about a month ago in the theater, and I saw Woody Harrelson as the lead actor, as LBJ, I thought to myself,
what?
Woody Harrelson. Yeah, I almost cursed right in front of all these people after watching the movie. But why Woody Harrelson? How did that, where did that come from?
You know, that's a great question, because I get that all the time. People, when you hear it's a movie about LBJ, you don't think Woody Harrelson. You think
John Goodman.
And a lot of people have played LBJ over the years, and there have been some great performances, even last year. Bryan Cranston was terrific in all the way. But I wanted, first of all, I wanted somebody from Texas who understood that mentality, and Woody's from Texas. But more than that, I wanted to get, I mean, I wanted to show LBJ in a complete picture. He was a very complicated guy, almost a Shakespearean character, and he had, you know, everybody has this image of LBJ being this kind of bull in a china shop, arm-twisting bully guy who kind of could get anything he wanted and got his way. But he also, as you can see in the film, and this is something that I learned in reading about him from Doris Kearns Goodwin, who wrote a wonderful biography about him, that he had this very sensitive side. He was insecure, very insecure at times, and at times, you know, he had this recurring dream where he was paralyzed, and he couldn't move, and he couldn't act. And you can see in the film there are times when he just doesn't, you know, he can't get off the dime, and then eventually through the strength that he gains from Lady Bird, he's able to move forward. And once he kicks into gear, then he's like gangbusters. And I wanted to get an actor who could give this humanity to him, you know, so it wasn't two-dimensional, that had not only, you know, the humanity, but also a sense of humor, which LBJ had. And I got to tell you, I mean, this was like the greatest response. I mean, we screened this in Austin, you know, at the LBJ Library. And Lucy Baines, Lyndon's daughter, was there. And we did a Q&A after, just like this. Woody was there, and we got up, and the guy started to ask a question, and I got, I was so nervous because Lucy was sitting right there in the front row, you know? And I'm thinking, I just want to know what she thinks. That's all I care about. And so I asked her, I said, just please tell me, what did you think of the film? And she said, she stood up. She's tiny. She's like your size. And she stood up, and very formally she said, "The man I saw on the screen tonight is the man I knew."
Aww.
And that was it. Well, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, I made this film a while ago, and at the time when I made the film, Donald Trump was not president.
No.
And it was, you know, I didn't jump at it initially because during the 60s, I was of draft age, you know, that's my era. And I, you know, LBJ was not, I was not a fan of LBJ because, you know, we could be drafted, we could be sent to Vietnam, and I didn't agree with that war at the time. But as the time has gone by, I've, you know, learned a lot. I've been in politics, I've been in government. I had a job in California government for 7 years, and I learned the difficulty of marrying a policy, government, and politics, and being able to move an agenda forward, and how difficult that is. And when I thought about LBJ, I had a different view of him, because had it not been for Vietnam, he would have gone down as one of the great presidents of all time. And when you think of his domestic record, you could hold it up, you know, maybe FDR and then LBJ. And when you think about the accomplishments he had, and when you think today of how difficult it is to get anything passed, and these were landmark pieces of legislation. We're talking about the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start. I mean, it goes on and on. So I had a completely different understanding of who he was and what he was able to accomplish. And so I said, I want to see if I can approach this. I mean, I still have the feelings that I had about him for Vietnam. And he himself, I did a lot of talking to some of the people at the LBJ Library. He felt trapped. You know, he didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to, he knew he couldn't win. And he didn't know how to get out. And he didn't want to be the president who lost a war to the communists. So it's almost like a Shakespearean character, but he has all these great qualities and he's very complex. And so I thought I would tackle him. Now, you know, we see with Trump here, it's interesting because the issues that we're dealing with, which is, you know, civil rights and race relations, and there have been many, many movies made about that over the years. And you always wonder, well, will people be interested? Are they going to, you know, is it going to be something that resonates? And yet we see now, because of what's happening in the country, there's this undercurrent of racism that has kind of bubbled up to the surface. And we're dealing with it again. And we're dealing with it in a very, you know, from Colin Kaepernick to the to what happened in Charlottesville. I mean, you know, it's all part of our discussion, our national dialogue again. So all of a sudden it becomes relevant again. So that.
So speaking of Shakespearean prose,
yeah,
and Trump, if LBJ was alive today, would he be tweeting from the first toilet?
He probably would. Yes, no, he would do any, I mean, when I prepared, I did this movie years ago called The American President, and in preparing that movie, I looked at, you know, you could look with Freedom of Information, all these records of schedules, of presidential schedules. And you can see, and I looked at everybody from Eisenhower up through, Reagan, and LBJ, of all the presidents, worked harder than anybody. I mean, the guy slept 3 or 4 hours a night, and you look at his schedule, there are phone calls at 3 o'clock in the morning, meetings. It never stopped. I mean, so he was, yes, he would have been tweeting. He would have been doing everything. I mean, whatever was available to him, he would do. He would utilize.
So beyond this film, obviously you've had decades of amazing movies. And I think we've spoken before that if it was now, some of those movies, or if those movies were made at a different point in time, they would have never gotten made.
Yeah, I don't think any of these would. I mean, I think about, the studio system now and the way it works. I mean, you've got some great films here, but I would say most of them, they're all independently financed. You know, and if you go to any festivals, you know, whether it's Toronto or Sundance, or we just came from Zurich where we showed another film, they're all independently financed films because the studios make one type of film, and that's, and I make the joke, but it's, if it has the word man and a number in the title, Spider-Man 6, Superman 4, Iron Man 3, Batman 12, whatever it is, there's a man and a number, and then you can make the movie. But if you don't have a man and a number, or it could be Wonder Woman 3, there could be a woman. But so I look at all these pictures, and my partner Greg Paul, who's introduced me to the Heartland Film Festival, and he still works with us at Castle Rock, and he knows because we've been together since I think 1987. It's 30 years now, and over the years we've made maybe 125 films, something like that, and not one of them would ever be made at a studio. And we've made, we had some pretty big successful pictures, but they're not the kinds of pictures that studios make. So even though we were distributed through, Columbia, Warner's, different studios, they wouldn't make the picture. And to give you a perfect example, I was in a film years ago, Wolf of Wall Street. And this movie was made by Martin Scorsese, one of the premier directors of all time, and it starred Leonardo DiCaprio, who was the biggest star in Hollywood. And they couldn't get anybody to finance it. 6 years it took them. They finally got this company, Red Granite, to finance it, and they got it to made, and then Paramount picked it up and they distributed. But that just goes to show you it's because it doesn't fit into that mold, that category, that, if it would have said Wolf of Man Street, they should have had Man. Man of Wall Street.
Speaking of, so Greg Paul, he's on our board. Greg Warren.
Stand up. Told me today, and I didn't know this, because I wondered how he was going to, his grandparents were born here in Indiana, and he showed me about the World War statue, the tribute you have to wear, and his grandfather fought in the First World War, and so he has real roots here in Indiana. And I wanted to introduce also, my wife Michelle is there, sitting next to Greg Paul. Reader, who's from Electric, the company that's distributing the film, and we're opening.
This week, Adam and I liked the Rob Reiner film, LBJ. I gave it a B grade. Adam was a little less impressed. He gave it a B minus. The film LBJ opens nationwide on November 3rd. Was also the opening film for the 2017 Heartland Film Festival. Hamilton County Goes to the Movies is recorded each week at Donatello's Italian Restaurant, 9 West Main Street in downtown Carmel. When you have dinner there, ask what gelato dessert Adam has created that night. We'll be back next Saturday for another edition of Hamilton County Goes to the Movies. In the meantime, thanks for listening. We'll talk again.